KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Simon Winchester is the British-born writer, traveler, and broadcaster. His books include The Professor and the Madman. His most recent book is called Skulls, and it's a fascinating look into the mystery and the science of the bones that cover our brains. Simon Winchester has worked as a field geologist, a correspondent for the London Times. For the Guardian newspaper, he covered Northern Ireland and Washington, D.C. He spent time in jail in Tierra del Fuego during the Falkland Islands conflict. His hobbies include letterpress printing, beekeeping, and cider making. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
So Skull focuses on photographs of Alan Dudley's extraordinary collection of both human and animal skulls. How did you tumble to Alan Dudley? How did you find out about him?
Well, a friend of mine in London who makes apps for the iPad rang up one day and said, have a look at the Daily Mail today. Now, the Daily Mail is, as you probably know, the most popular online newspaper in the world. It's also one of the most irresponsible and badly written newspapers in the world, too, being excoriated in the Leveson Inquiry report published in London today by coincidence. But they had a story saying, you know, 56-year-old man arrested in Coventry for having, basically for having skulls he shouldn't have. And it was about this man who lives a life, his profession is to select the veneer for the dashboards of Jaguar motor cars. I mean, who knew that there was a chap with such a profession, but that's what he does in the daytime. And it turned out that he had amassed over the years in a very ordinary suburban house in an extremely ordinary English town, Coventry, probably the biggest and most taxonomically comprehensive collection of skulls anywhere on the planet, certainly any privately held collection. 300-odd thousand. I mean, there are, 58,000 species that have skulls, and divided between, you know, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, birds and fishes. And he, Alan, had a comprehensive bunch of each of those five classes. But he had strayed accidentally, I now think, and the court agreed, by buying a howler monkey, a penguin, a chimpanzee and a marmoset, which trade in which is banned under the CITES convention. So this friend of mine that rang me said, we should make an app about this man's amazing collection. So I flew over to London, went up to Coventry and saw him and was completely amazed by this collection. And we did indeed. We spent about a year preparing an app, which did moderately well. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, but we thought what we really want to do is to be old-fashioned and produce a book. And so a publishing house in New York, Black Dog, came along and have produced this absolutely extraordinary, I think it's a very beautiful book. It's a bit of a departure for me, but I really became very engaged in it.
And this is the first time a lot of these pictures of these skulls have been seen publicly. He's got this extraordinary collection. Is it not well-known among people who know skulls?
Well, I think among the small subset of people that know skulls, yes, I think Alan Dudley's quite famous, but I turned up in the street that he lives in and obviously had the wrong number for him and hammering on a number of doors very close to his. And you'd think he'd have some sort of local notoriety. And people next door said, no, I've no idea. There's a bloke next door that's got skulls. I said, yes, the biggest skull collection in the world is right next door to you.
In his second bedroom.
Yes. Basically, I don't want to get super grotesque about this, but the way he prepares the skulls is he basically puts the head of an animal in a bucket of cold water. It's called cold water maceration, and leaves it there for several months, and the water goes black and extremely smelly while the bacteria do their work.
You found out the maggots were too rough.
Maggots are too rough. They're really aggressive. They have a feeding frenzy and so damage the more delicate bones, the internal nasal bones of skulls. But the smell pervaded the house, which caused his wife to leave him. So all of a sudden, a bedroom became free, and he filled that up with skulls. So it's sort of outwardly rather sad portrait of this now lovelorn man with surrounded by these rather macabre artifacts. But they're so beautiful, and his knowledge of them is profound.
And as are the photos. Simon Winchester, as you point out, there's sort of a checkered history of people who study skulls. When it comes to Alan Dudley, is he kind of squarely in the scientific realm?
No, I think he's not really. He's in the collecting realm. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read John Fowles' book, The Collector. Collects butterflies in that case, and then decides that he just loves collecting things, and he then moves on in the case of the novel to collecting human beings, and of course that ends out tragically. But no, I think Alan, at least initially, just became enthralled by things that when you remove the flesh and the fur, his first ever animal was a red fox. And certainly when you look at the picture of the red fox skull in the book, you think this is a thing of uncommon beauty with all the parts of it, you know, the rostrum and the cranium and the mandible and the zygomatic arches and the sagittal ridge and all the things that, that a scientist would readily identify. And he thought he'd simply collect them as one might collect matchboxes or, you know, beer bottles or whatever. But then he got more scientifically interested and then became an authority. Mm-hmm. And zoos all over the country and indeed all over the world would say, look, we've got a hippopotamus that's dying once it's, you know, popped its clogs. Would you come and take its head off and and we'll and turn it into a skull? And he did. And so his collection is now world class and people come to him now.
But some people who've studied skulls have done it kind of in an anti-scientific sense, too, as you recount.
Well, yes. I mean, and this is really what the book is all about. The core of the book is the collection of Alan Dudley. But what the publishers asked me to do was to look more closely at the skull, the way that we as humankind venerate the skull and indeed collect it and use it in all sorts of ways. I mean, artistically, and I dwell a lot, for instance, on the famous Holbein photograph, rather piece of art called The Ambassadors, which has this peculiar smear across the bottom of it, which if you jiggle the picture, well, it's difficult to jiggle because it's 7 feet by 7 feet, you can see it turns into a skull. It's a magical thing to see.
It just looks like a smear in the painting. But then when you look at it, why is the skull there? It's just fascinated artists.
It is, and it's what they call a memento mori, a reminder of death, that however grand the portrait of these two ambassadors who are clad in ermine and jewels and things, that they're going to die and they're going to turn into bones mm-hmm. at the end of their lives. So, excuse me, I look at things like that and I look at the weird scientific, the role that the skull is played in weird pseudoscience, things like phrenology, where these crazy German scientists came up with the idea that if you became very good at, let's say, calculation, or if you were good at seducing people, the part of your brain that did that would grow enormously. It would bulge and cause your skull to bulge, and that men with delicate fingers could run them over the surface of your head and find a bulge and say, clearly this man is a seducer, or this man is very good at mathematics or something, and charge you 2 guineas for a diagnosis. A complete poppycock, of course, complete nonsense. So there's that sort of thing. And craniometry, the measurement of the skull, which made an American called Morton come to conclusions about racial differences in skulls, from which he created a hierarchy, mm-hmm. showing that there were the so-called dolichocephalic skulls possessed by Aryans, which were superior to the brachycephalic skulls possessed by Jewish people, which proved, in quotes, that Aryan people were superior. And so racial theories depended from this. So the skulls got people into a lot of trouble.
And the symbolism is so varied and so omnipresent. I just took some skulls down off my window lately finally after Halloween. I took the skulls down. And alas, poor Yorick and Hamlet
yes.
and the Grateful Dead, their symbol is a skull. Have skulls always held such fascination for humans?
They really have. I mean, you go to the oldest of middens and grave sites and you find that, you know, where you might say, why don't we revere the pelvis? That is, after all, where life comes from, or the biggest bones in the body, you know, the thigh bone, which is massive. And why the skull? And it's because even though people 5,000 years ago didn't really recognize what the gray matter inside it did, clearly that is the locus of thought and feeling, and of course the sense organs are there, and you speak out of it, and you see through the holes in it, and smell things through it, and taste things through it. So it was clearly, even to the most primitive societies, a very, very important part of the human body, and so invariably was the one that was preserved and put up on shelves in caves and so forth. So yes, no other part of the body has been as revered, not even the heart, as has the head and its encasing.
I was just in a little store in downtown Seattle called Belfry, and they had a simulated skull sitting there. I think it was selling for $240, so it retains the fascination. You know, you mentioned the Leveson inquiry, so I have to ask you about that. iPad. As someone who's written for many newspapers from Great Britain, this relates to some of the malfeasance that took place with stealing information off of people's cell phones that's been bedeviling journalism and Fox and a lot going on in Great Britain. Well, this inquiry, as I understand the results that came out today, concluded that the government in Great Britain should step in and set some standards controlling what is printed and published and broadcast in Great Britain. I wonder what your reaction was to that.
Very dangerous precedent, I think. I mean, we have an enormously rambunctious press in the British Isles, as you know. I mean, we've got Londoners can read 13 daily newspapers, which, I mean, no other city in the United States and very few cities in the world have this range of papers. And they range from the ultra-respectable, like the Times and the Guardian, to the the Sun and much, much less respectable and highly irresponsible newspapers. So how to rein them in, how to stop them hacking people's telephones, which was the thing that prompted the Leveson inquiry. Do you do it with government regulation? And I think you do not. I think that's the slippery, that's the thin end of a very dangerous wedge, because that would lead to government control of the press, and we do not want that to happen. The press in Britain has got to regulate itself. There's got to be a self-regulating code of conduct. There has been nominally one in Britain for the last 20 years, but it's utterly toothless. There are no sanctions that the what's called the Press Complaints Commission can exert on a wayward press. And I think it is entirely wrong. And I think David Cameron, anyway, as Prime Minister, is saying, no, we don't want government controls on the press. The others, the Liberals and the Labour Party, are saying, well, maybe we should.
Well, that's what I was wondering. You live here now, but what's your read on this? The Leveson report is just a report, but it does recommend the government become more involved in regulating the news media. Do you think that this has traction when it comes to actually becoming law?
Well, as far as I see, just before I came to the studio today, the Miliband, the Labour leader, has said the government should accept the report in its entirety and therefore, yes, probably pass legislation. The Conservative, as you know, it's a coalition and a somewhat uneasy coalition. And it's odd that the way that it's split, the Tory, David Cameron, says, no, we don't want regulation. Whereas his Liberal Party sidekick,
Liberal in quotes, I guess.
Liberal in quotes with small l, said maybe we should. So it's splitting in a somewhat unconventional, unpredictable, unexpected way, with the Tories being against press, government control of the press. Who knows where it'll... I think the British public was horrified by some of the excesses, particularly of the Murdoch press in Britain, particularly with one's awful case of phone hacking. And the fact that a number of well-known film stars like Hugh Grant had their phones hacked and therefore go on television very plausibly, very handsome young man, and all the housewives in Britain are saying, oh, if he's in trouble, then we ought to have the government control the press. I think that's rather dangerous.
They hacked the wrong phone.
Indeed. They only hack ugly people's phones. Yes.
Writer and traveler and broadcaster Simon Winchester is my guest. His new book is called Skulls, and it's about an amazing collection of skulls and also about the place that it holds in our culture. Yesterday on the show, we were talking about how few communities here in Washington State any longer have a local radio station or a local newspaper reporting on what's going on. And you spend a lot of your time in Western Massachusetts, where I also grew up, in a really small town called Sandusfield. And you got together with some people in Sandusfield kind of to address that issue in your small town, didn't you?
Yes, we actually started a little newspaper 3 years ago. We're having our third birthday just after Christmas. And it's 16, occasionally 20, very occasionally 24 pages. And they love it, the people, because the really, really hyper-local news that we give our 724 residents is something that you cannot find on the internet. Our local paper, as you will remember from your time living in Pittsfield, is the Berkshire Eagle. Now, that is a regional paper, and that is being slowly destroyed by the online world, because the online world covers events in moderately large towns like Pittsfield, where you come from, and Great Barrington, where I go shopping. But the tiny little villages, of which there are many in the Western Massachusetts, they fall completely under the radar of the internet. And so there is a market there. And I don't say that because we make money out of the paper, quite the reverse. It's all run by volunteers. But there is a market, an appetite for really, really hyper-local news. people in the community, everyone doesn't buy, it's free, takes our newspaper. And it's become something of a success.
It's so interesting to me that you did it as a newspaper. I was reading you being interviewed at the beginning of this experiment, and it was almost a reaction to things going online. But many people have done the same kind of local, hyper-local coverage, but gone online. Why did you decide to do a newspaper? And now, a few years into this, how's it going?
Well, it is going very well. We produce an online version, but it's a PDF file. In other words, it's not a, you can't click on stories like you can, you know, with your local newspapers and the New York Times and so forth. So it's a pretty primitive web presence. We had an incident the other day when after we had gone to press, a truck, an asphalt truck, demolished our only local store, the little country store, completely trashed it. And so we had to cover it, but of course we couldn't go back to press for another 30 days because the next issue of the paper wasn't coming out for a month. So we then used the internet. And that had, extraordinarily, we were able to track it, it had 30,000 hits, including in places like Borneo. I mean, the fact that someone in Borneo would be interested in a truck demolishing a store in Western Massachusetts enthralled me. But so the paper, the locals absolutely love it. They line up at the post office to get their copies each month, and it's a great success as a paper product.
You've been a journalist for decades. What's it been like to kind of be a little bit on the other side? You're also a journalist with your small local paper, but you're kind of a publisher too.
I am. Well, actually, I've sort of stepped down from being editor, so I am president, which is rather nice, of the Sandersfield Times, and publisher. And indeed, my task, which I will have to finish it when I go back to my hotel this afternoon, is to write the annual begging letter to people saying, please give us money, because we're now, you know, we're a 501c3 organization, a charity organization. But it's enormous fun. And you feel you have a sort of sense of power and have influence. We are changing the way this little village is run. We are putting heat on the selectmen. You perhaps don't know in the west of America that we have what are called selectmen who run the town. And they have run the town for decades without any public scrutiny. All of a sudden, our eyes are on you and they're running scared and they're doing what we want, which is lovely.
Well, Simon, beware the power of the press magnate. We know it can be abused if there is too much
There's always Rosebud.
Simon Winchester, his most recent book is called Skulls, and he's got a new book that he's going to be coming out soon calling The Men Who United the States, and maybe we'll have you back to talk about that too.
I hope so.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been fun. Thank you.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Joshua McNichols, and Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.